Judges is about the first generation of Israelites living in the land. There's no king. There's no capital city. There's no organized structure by which people might be educated about the law of Moses. There is a tabernacle. There are priests. But most of that is about sacrifices and purity and forgiveness. It's just a quite interesting period. There are 12 tribes. Each of the tribes are given a tribal allotment, and more or less during the period of Judges, they're ruling independently of one another. So these are not chronological stories. It's not as though Gideon ruled before Samson, ruled before Deborah, because that's the order they're in. So it's an interesting book. But there are two things we have to remember as we study Judges, and I will remind us every week of this series of these two things. First, there's a cycle, a pattern that the people in the book of Judges live into over and over and over again. And that pattern is intended to help us living today, years and years after this, to understand the way in which God works with the peoples of the earth. And the cycle is this. The people begin to rebel against the law of God and live according to their own values. God judges them by handing them over to their enemies. After a period of judgment, God raises up a deliverer who rescues them from their enemies. And that follows in a period of peace and faithfulness to the law of Moses. And then once again, when the deliverer dies, the people go back into rebellion and the cycle repeats itself over and over again. So that's important for the book of Judges. And there's a theme in the book of Judges. It's repeated three times throughout the book. It's the final verse of the book. I'm just going to read it from Judges 21, verse 25. It says this, "In those days there was no king in Israel. All the people did what was right in their own eyes." We're in Judges chapter 1. I'm going to begin reading in verse 1, and I'm reading from the New Revised Standard Version. "After the death of Joshua, the Israelites inquired of the Lord, 'Who shall go up first for us against the Canaanites to fight against them?' The Lord said, 'Judah shall go up. I hereby give the land into his hand.' Judah said to his brother Simeon," these are two tribes, "'come up with me into the territory allotted to me, and we may fight against the Canaanites. Then I too will go with you into the territory allotted to you.' So Simeon went with him. Then Judah went up, and the Lord gave the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hand, and they defeated 10,000 of them at Bezek. They came upon Adoni-Bezek at Bezek and fought against him and defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. Adoni-Bezek fled, but they pursued him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and big toes. Adoni-Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off used to pick up scraps under my table. As I have done, so God has paid me back.' They brought him to Jerusalem, and he died there. Then the people of Judah fought against Jerusalem and took it. They put it to the sword and set the city on fire. Afterward, the people of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites who lived in the hill country, in the Negev, and in the lowlands. Judah went against the Canaanites who live in Hebron. The name of Hebron was formerly Kiriath Arba, and they defeated Sheshai and Ahiman and Talmai. From there, they went against the inhabitants of Debir. The name of Debir was formerly Kiriath Sepher. Then Caleb said, 'Whoever attacks Kiriath Sepher and takes it, I'll give him my daughter Aksa as wife.' And Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it, and he gave him his daughter Aksa as wife. When she came to him, she urged him to ask her father for a field. As she dismounted from her donkey, Caleb said to her, 'What do you wish?' She said to him, 'Give me a present, since you've set me in the land of the Negev.'" That's down south. It's all desert. And she's saying, "It's a wonderful gift you've given to me. There's no water. So can you please give me two wells?" So that's what she's asking for. So Caleb gave her Upper Galot and Lower Galot. The descendants of Hobab the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up with the people of Judah from the city of Palms into the wilderness of Judah, which lies in the Negev near Arad. Then they went and settled with the Amalekites. Judah went with his brother Simeon, and they defeated the Canaanites who inhabited Zephath and devoted it to destruction. So the city was called Hormah. Judah took Gaza with its territory, Ashkelon with its territory, and Ekron with its territory. This is near the plain in present-day Gaza. The Lord was with Judah, and he took possession of the hill country, but could not drive out the inhabitants of the plain because they had chariots of iron. Hebron was given to Caleb, as Moses had said, and he drove out from it three sons of Anak. But the Benjamites did not drive out the Jebusites who lived in Jerusalem, so the Jebusites have lived in Jerusalem among the Benjamites to this day. We don't know when Judges was written, so we don't know till what day. The house of Joseph also went up against Bethel, and the Lord was with them. The house of Joseph sent out spies to Bethel. The name of the city was formerly Luz.
When the spies saw a man coming out of the city, they said to him, "Show us the way into the city and we'll deal kindly with you." So he showed them the way into the city and they put the city to the sword, but they let the man and all his family go. So the man went to the land of the Hittites and built a city and named it Luz. That is its name to this day. Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants, this is even further north, of Beth Shean and its villages. So from here on out, from verse 27 to the end of the chapter, which we're going to read, we're going to hear all the people Israel did not conquer. Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shean and its villages, or Tanaak and its villages, or the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Ibleam and its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages, but the Canaanites continued to live in that land. When Israel grew strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but did not in fact drive them out. And Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites who lived in Gezer, but the Canaanites lived among them in Gezer. Zebulun did not drive out the inhabitants of Kitron, or the inhabitants of Nahalal, but the Canaanites lived among them and became subject to forced labor. Asher did not drive out the inhabitants of Akko, or the inhabitants of Sidon, or of Alab, or Achzib, or Helba, or of Afik, or of Rehob. But the Asherites lived among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. Naphtali did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh, or the inhabitants of Beth Anat, but lived among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land. Nevertheless, the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh and of Beth Anat became subject to forced labor for them. The Amorites pressed the Danites back into the hill country. They did not allow them to come down to the plain. The Amorites continued to live in the Hahirs, in Ahilan, and in Sha'albim, but the hand of the house of Joseph rested heavily on them, and they became subject to forced labor. The border of the Amorites ran from the ascent of Akrabim, from Selah, and upward. The title of the sermon today is of sowing and reaping. Of sowing and reaping. And it's a big picture kind of message as we enter into this book. Because what we have to understand is that God is fairly consistent in the way he works with nations and with peoples. And the book of Judges falls in the middle of a particular type of activity of God in history. And it's a type that we have to be aware of. Because we live in these same patterns according to the New Testament as the people of Israel did in the Old or the First Testament. And so I want to begin, all that is just preliminary, really. I want to begin by talking about something that's all over the book of Judges, and it's the idea of balance. What does it mean for God to be just? What does it mean for God to be merciful? What does it mean to live in a time in which God is not punishing evil? And what does it mean to live in a time in which God has decided to punish evil? These are the questions of the book of Judges. And as we think about the idea of balance, I want to just expose, I think, some presuppositions that we have. Eastern religions have long emphasized the balance of nature. You can almost get this idea that there's only so much of everything in the world, we all have to share it, and if somebody has a lot, somebody else doesn't have any. It's kind of a closed system. Even in our lives, we say things like, well, things have been going well, but I'm kind of waiting for the other shoe to fall, right? As though there's kind of only so much blessing in the world. If I've had a lot of it, curse has to come. And for many of us, this is the essence of justice. When we talk of justice, we believe that one good turn deserves another, that people should get what they give. The book of Judges explores those kinds of spaces. Is that really the world in which we live? Is that really the way God operates? What does it mean for God to be just? What does it mean for God to be loving, forgiving, patient? The book of Judges explores those spaces historically, theologically, narratively. I think it's going to be a good series. Is there a cycle or a pattern or a logic to God's justice? How might we understand and even anticipate God's interactions with the people and nations of the earth? Does God seek balance, or is justice of another sort for God? We're going to explore those patterns of God's mercy and judgment today, the justice and the graciousness of our God, and the patterns of the reality God has created. And I think in the course of studying those things, we'll better, I hope, come to understand our place in the world now in the season of God's interactions with us in which we find ourselves, and we might even get a glimpse of the future, of what God will inevitably do because it's what he has always done. I invite you to turn to the book of Exodus. Exodus chapter 34, verses 5 through 7. The Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name Yahweh. Yahweh passed before him and proclaimed, Yahweh, Yahweh, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for the thousandth generation, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, yet by no means clearing the guilty, but visiting the iniquity of the parents upon the children and the children's children to the third and the fourth generation. This is who God says he is. Our question will be throughout the series in Judges, what does it look like for God to be slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love, forgiving iniquity and visiting it upon those who do evil? And we're going to begin with God's claim that he's merciful and gracious, slow to anger. Now, I read that whole big, long chapter, right? In Judges. Did you see a lot of grace and mercy there? So how can we start with the claim that even here in Judges, God is merciful and gracious? Well, there's a story we haven't been told. It's hinted at in the scriptures, and we're going to look at one of the passages that hint it. But there's a story we haven't been told about God's involvement with the people of Canaan. In fact, God has been working with the people of Canaan for almost 1,000 years at this point in history. The book of Judges details a time when God is finally bringing judgment on them after delaying it for nearly 1,000 years. That story is hinted at in Genesis chapter 15. In that context, God was making a covenant, an agreement with Abraham about his offspring and his future generations who would come from him. And this is what God says. I'm going to begin reading in Genesis chapter 15, verse 13. Then the Lord said to Abram, "Know this for certain, that your offspring shall be aliens in a land that is not theirs, and shall be slaves there, and they shall be oppressed for 400 years. Verse 16, "And they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." So the story of Abraham is somewhere around 2200 BC, maybe 2500 BC. It's always hard to tell. And according to the biblical dates, the Israelites were delivered from slavery in Egypt in 1446. So we're almost 1,000 years from Abraham to the time when God delivered them. Now, I understand it's hard to see God's mercy and grace and patience upon the inhabitants of the land of Canaan simply in Judges. But the story we haven't been told hints that God has been working with them for almost 1,000 years, and they have remained intractable in their sin. They have refused to turn toward God. Now, we don't know the stories. We don't know if God sent prophets to them, though there are little hints, like in the story of Abraham, that there are people who worship the one true God in this land, who's not Abraham. Melchizedek being one who's talked about in Genesis. And however God talked with them, whether it was through prophets or whether it was through priests or whether he came to them directly, over the course of nearly 1,000 years, they absolutely refused to have anything to do with him. They refused to change their ways. And after 1,000 years, God calls on the people of Israel to go in and to bring his judgment on the people. And part of that is interesting because it means Israel was in slavery for 400 years in Egypt, because God was being merciful to the Canaanites. We don't know what the story would have been if the Canaanites had followed God, because they didn't. Maybe it would have been a different story. But in the days of Joshua and of Judges, the time of God's mercy had run out. Now, what I want to say for us is that our lifespans are so short. I mean, the oldest of us barely live over 100 years old, right? And most of us don't live that long, and most of us today are nowhere near that age. Our lifespans are so short that it's hard to see the big arc of history that God is working with. To understand why God is behaving the way he is, we have to understand where we are on the arc of history. In the book of Judges, they were in a season of God's judgment. God had put up with the Canaanite people and worked with them for 1,000 years. They remained intractable, and God had decided to punish them for their sins. And terrible things were done in Canaan. When the Israelites came into that land, they found that they were sacrificing their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods, that they were killing each other in the name of their gods and doing human sacrifices, and all other kinds of strange, bizarre activities that God found abominable. And after 1,000 years, he decided to put an end to it. That sounds so ancient, right? We wouldn't want God to destroy anybody until the Nazis came and everybody was blood hungry. When evil rises and things get scary and terrifying, we want protection. And eventually God brings it in the form of Israel's judgment on the people of Canaan, but not quickly. When we look over history, we notice that these seasons, like the book of Judges, when God is judging the world, they're rare and they're short. In fact, over the long course of history, there seems to be a lot more evil than good, a lot more wicked societies than just societies, a lot more suffering than pleasure. And we can be led to believe that God is a terrible governor. But the book of Judges and the story of the Amorite people and God's delay in punishing them tells us one story. And it's that evil looks to be dominant, not because it's more powerful than God, but because God is so ridiculously gracious. Why did he give them 1,000 years? Why did he give the Nazis 40 years? Why did he give the church its centuries of dominant control in which it abused its power in Europe? God is merciful, slow to anger, patient with the wicked, and for that reason, when judgment comes, it comes, but it often takes hundreds, if not thousands, of years in coming. In the book of Judges, it's coming, but it had been a long time in coming. God certainly seems to be true to his description of himself, that he's merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. And yet he says that he will not vindicate the wicked, but he visits iniquity on those who do evil. Looking back at our story in Judges chapter 1, verse 7, we see a little piece of that theme that's going to be recurrent through the book of Judges in the story of Adonibezek. Adonibezek is a wicked king. He has slaughtered many kings, and he cut off all of their thumbs and big toes. Well, why would you do that? A sadistic pig, right? Well, it's so that they couldn't fight again. Without thumbs, you can't hold a weapon. Without big toes, you really can't run quickly. So he's taking them out of contention for rebellion. And so God instructs the Israelites to go and do to him what he had done to 70 others. And that is a theme in the book of Judges. When we enter into a season, like in the book of Judges, of God's judgment falling on a people, God repays the evil that has been done over the generations to the people who are doing evil in that generation. Israel's primary victories all occurred in the hill country, though they could not defeat those in the plains. That's what that whole history was telling us. So even when God's judgment comes, even when God is determined that people should reap what they sow, he still leaves those who are being judged with some recourse to fight back. That's interesting too. Judgment does come though, however slow, and eventually humanity reaps what it sows. God's forgiveness lasts for centuries, but his judgment comes, and it will come again. And woe to the generation who sees that day, for their suffering is in large part the consequence of the generations who came before them. The decisions you and I make in our lives on whether we follow God or we don't, whether we live into the kingdom Jesus encourages us to live into or we don't, it's oftentimes not us who pay those penalties. It's the future that does. It's our children and our grandchildren who will suffer for us. The Apostle Paul, in his speech to the philosophers of Athens in Acts chapter 16, verse 26, has said, "From one ancestor, God made all nations to inhabit the whole earth, and he allotted the times of their existence and the boundaries of the places where they would live, so that they would search for God." Nations have time frames. And none of them are forever. God has set the limits. And when God finally does bring that nation down, the manner in which nations fall is dependent on their relationship with God. So God does bring judgment. But here's the final point. Where are we? Where are we? Jesus has done much to help us to understand where we are on the arc of God's history. We are in one of those periods within that 1,000 years of forbearance where God is being patient. Israel in Deuteronomy was commanded to be God's vessel of judgment on the peoples of the land of Canaan after centuries of merciful forbearance on the part of God. In the future, God would call the Assyrians and the Babylonians to wreak similar judgment on the people of Israel after they refused to follow the law. However, the book of the law was given to us as Christians, not by Moses, but by the new Moses, by Jesus. And his instructions on how to deal with evil during this period of human history have to remain as absolute for us as war and weapons of war were absolute for people in the days of Judges. But we don't live in a time of judgment. We live in a day of salvation. And for that reason, Jesus says that we are to love our enemies and pray for those who persecute us. That we are to allow the law of God to not just penetrate our behavior, our hands and our feet, but to penetrate our very souls, to penetrate our characters, to penetrate the very people we are. This is the way the people of God live in this time. Israel was called in when the time of God's mercy on the Canaanite peoples had expired. But Christians are called to follow Jesus during a period not of God's judgment, but of God's mercy. And we must participate during this season, however long it may be, as agents of grace. And God has promised that the time of judgment will come. And for those who love that that's coming, you read Revelation and you read it over and you read it over and you read it over again to remind us that God's judgment is coming. That when Jesus comes again, he will lead the onslaught to finish the nations of evil. But in this time between the times, we are to be agents of grace. Because we live with a God who at this time is showing mercy on the people of the earth. And we will suffer for that mercy, but we must also embrace it. Revelation tells of that time when that mercy will end. And on that day, humanity will reap what it has sown. But we live in a day of mercy. And Jesus has told us how to deal with evil during this epoch. Forgive when you are sinned against. Pray for your enemies. Care for the hurting and the helpless. Follow the example and teachings of Jesus in your everyday lives in every way. This is what the church is called to do. When Israel was called to take up the sword, they took it. But they didn't do it well. Did you catch that? God told them to drive out these nations. They had sinned for 1,000 years, and God wanted the evil done. He wanted no more children sacrificed on the fires. He wanted no more women raped for a prostitute festival to get gods to do stuff. He wanted no more people put out and robbed and pillaged by policy of law. He wanted no more of it, and yet they moved in and they left them. They didn't do it. People had chariots, they left them alone. People were entrenched, they let them be. Those compromises forced God's judgment never to come on those nations, and their evil continued for generations. And the Israelites even co-opted some of their behaviors and continued to do the same evil, oppressing their own people in the same ways the Canaanites had, because they refused to do what God told them to do in their season. What are we doing in our season? Are we forgiving those who sin against us? Are we praying for our persecutors? Are we laying down our lives for Jesus? Are we doing to others what we would want them to do to us? Are we loving our neighbor as ourselves? Or are we just like the Israelites in a day of judgment, told to drive out the Canaanites who decide it's easier to live with them? Are we the same? Rather than embodying the law of Jesus and doing what he's asked us to do in this season, do we too just compromise and it's easier to just leave and let live and let live and do some things good and hope it overwhelms the badness? Just like Israel, if we do not do what God has entrusted us to do in our time, our children and our nation will be destroyed for it. And we are not called to take up swords. That's not where we are. We are called to lead with grace and forgiveness and mercy and patience. And if we refuse to do it, then our future is the future of Israel as well. We must be faithful to the task God has entrusted to our time. And the tasks he has entrusted to us are those Jesus gave us as the church. According to Genesis, it was 1,500 years between the time when Cain murdered his brother and God brought the flood. 1,500 years. That might be a symbolic number, might be literal. Either way, it's a long time. It was 1,000 years between the time that he called Abraham and the time he sent the Israelites in to destroy the Canaanites. 1,000 years of mercy. It was 1,000 years from the time that the Israelites came into the land and God finally destroyed them with the Babylonians for their evil. Another 1,000 years. But his time of mercy has been shortening up until the coming of Jesus. Greece didn't have as long to rule. The Persians didn't have as long to rule. But after Jesus, God's mercy got kicked into high gear again. And it's now been 2,000 years of mercy. And you've suffered for it, and so have I. But God will bring his judgment when he's ready. But it's not given to us to speed his judgment. It's given to us to behave as Jesus has called us to behave in our time as people of grace. And as we close the sermon today, let's hear Paul's words from Galatians chapter 6. Verses 7 to 10. This is God's word to us. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For you reap whatever you sow. If you sow to your own flesh, you'll reap corruption from the flesh. But if you sow to the Spirit, you will reap eternal life from the Spirit. So let us not grow weary in doing what is right. When the world oppresses us, when nation rises against nation, when natural disasters threaten to upend our faith, when we have to face death and suffering and pain, let us not grow weary in doing what is right. He has given us no quarter on forgiveness in this time. Peter asked it, right? He said, well, how often should I forgive my brother when he sins against me? 7 times would be really gracious. Especially if he keeps doing the same thing to me. And Jesus' response is not 7 times, but 70 times 7 times. He's given us no opportunity for justice. We trust that his justice will come. So let us not grow weary in doing what is right, for we will reap at harvest time if we do not give up. So then, whenever we have an opportunity, let us work for the good of all, and especially for those of the family of faith. This is the word that God gave Paul to say to us. God will bring justice. Do not worry. Humanity will reap what it has sown. But you and I live in the day of salvation, a day of God's mercy. And he has asked us to be ambassadors of the grace and mercy of God in the time between when his judgment has come and when it will again. We do not doubt God's resolve to do good, but he has asked us to be vessels of mercy. Can we trust him?